everybody. Welcome back to That's Criminal. Before I get started, I want to announce a new thing that we're doing here at TCP. Everyone's been so supportive as I get this show off the ground, and I wanted to figure out a way to give back a little bit. So what we're going to do from now on is anyone who likes, subscribes, and rates the TCP, I'm going to send them a free ebook. So by either dropping me a DM on Instagram or Facebook, or Twitter, or sending me an email at john@johnstampwriter.com. You check that box for me and I'll send you one of my titles, either Brother's Keeper, Shedder's Circle, or Wraith of Sheltermount. I wanted to figure out a way of saying thank you for all the great support that you guys have given me so far. So that's the way I'm going to do it for right now. We'll come up with something more later, but you give me a subscription, you subscribe and you like, I will send you a book. And, going along in that same route, don't forget about what I told you last episode, that every time you like or subscribe to TCP, an internet troll gets nailed by a dump truck. That still holds true. And it's just another reason to subscribe, get a free ebook, and make the internet a little bit better place while you do it. So public service, it's what we do here at the TCP. And speaking of public service, I get to talk to a dedicated public servant tonight. Paula May has been a sworn law enforcement officer in the state of North Carolina since 1989. Last 10 years of that, she served as a chief of police before retiring. Prior to that, she served as a detective investigating major violent crimes in upstate North Carolina. She's got two books I want to talk to her about tonight. The first, First Degree Rage, the true crime story of the assassin and obsession and murder. And the follow-on to that, Raging On, covers the case of Lamont Underwood, a police officer convicted of murdering his estranged girlfriend's new man and possibly her mother in 1993. So, Paula, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah, I jumped into First Degree Rage, and I know we'll get to the part about the mother later on, but just to start, like I'm still shivering from that that chapter when you discover Gunnarsson's body, like the way that you put it out there that you planned an office day and left the gear at home and walking around up to your knees in snow in the middle of a mountain. Oh man, that brought back memories of directing traffic in the middle of the winter with absolutely no gear on whatsoever. So thanks for bringing me back.
Right.
Yeah, bringing me back to that dark place.
Certainly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I still, as soon as I read that, especially about you walking in a foot of snow wearing like office shoes, I completely remembered going to work, not that cold out, thinking everything's cool, going to be an easy day. And
right.
You know, the weather just trashes. And some lady decides to wrap her car around a tree at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And here I am like 20 degree weather for like the next 4 hours. I'm like, oh, that hurt. You know, wearing like a windbreaker.
Yeah.
Yep. So no, I love the readability of this book. Like you jump right in and it's not technical. It's not, it flows really, really well. And especially the way you describe some of the aspects of working with the other police, there were a couple nuggets in there that I keyed on, like, and I don't want to give anything away. I don't want to take away from you, but that part where the park service shows up and you guys start bickering, it was over where the line is and who dragged the body across the line. That was
we used to mess 39 to, feet. It was 39 feet off federal property.
Yeah. Yeah. We used to mess with the county about that all the time. So, but yeah, I want to take away from you. I want to hear about your book. So if you'd like, you want to break us, you know, start us off with how these came about, how these two books came about.
Right. Well, for many years I've investigated violent crimes, but this case in particular, I really felt compelled to write about it because the details were just so extraordinary. And there were so many plot twists and turns as the case progressed. And actually ended up investigating the case probably close to 4 years before we went to trial on it. So it was a very long and involved case. And I was I mean, I've lived it, ate and breathed it, you know, for all of those months. But what happened was, as you said, I was in the office, and it was the 7th of January in 1994, and it was slow. It had been slow all week because the weather had been so bad. This is right in the heart of the Appalachian Mountains, and we had had several cold spells and snowstorms. And so this was a Friday, and it was my turn on call, but I really wasn't expecting to have anything much. And after lunch, I was contacted in the office by our dispatch center, and they're like, you're going to need to go out. We had a call from a survey crew, like a land survey crew, and they were walking in the snowy woods, and one man came upon a pair of bare feet sticking up out of the snow. So at that point, you know, I'm sure you are familiar. You're thinking, well, maybe, you know, it's a human and maybe it's not. You know, people find bones all the time and they think they've, you know, found a murder victim, and it, you know, it might be someone's dog or livestock or something. But so we went out there, and I was inappropriately dressed. And because of the weather, I had not driven my assigned car, which was just a two-wheel drive Crown Victoria. And so I didn't have all my gear that I needed, and it was very cold, and it got colder. But sure enough, when I was led to the body by the first deputy on the scene, it was definitely an adult, appeared to be a male, pretty good size. We could see the outline of his body under the snow. And again, his bare feet were sticking up out of the snow. And it looked like he'd been there a while, even before we removed the snow, because there had been some animal activity. Some of his toes were missing on one of his feet. So we did discover that it was a white male, middle-aged, really nice-looking male, handsome, beautiful set of white teeth, still, you know, under the snow there as we uncovered him. But he was nude. And so immediately, of course, you know, you're thinking some kind of crazy sexual assault, or, you know, who knows what, but, or maybe a suicide, because it was in the woods in the kind of a scenic area where people visit, but only in the summertime. But he was also wearing a watch and a ring. Other than that, he did not have anything on his body. But he had a nice, looked like about a .22 caliber bullet wound to his left temple and one to the right side of his neck, and no weapons on the scene. So immediately suicide is no longer, you know, an option. So, of course, we knew at that point that we had a homicide, but we had no idea of who he was. We did not have any missing persons at that particular time that fit his description. So that is how the case began. So we ended up processing the scene there. There was no other evidence at all found on the scene except for one length of tape. And it was maybe 18 inches long. And it was both masking tape and electrical tape, kind of a mass that was bound together. Clearly appeared to be cut from someone's, where it had been wrapped around someone's head, because there was human head hair on the adhesive part of the tape. There was blood droplets and one of the bullet holes. So we assumed that it was, you know, wrapped around his head.
Yeah, and
apparently the killer had dropped it.
Yeah, which, just thinking about that rural area off the beaten path in the snow, you know, I think you refer to it as a divine intervention in the book, or luck, but the simple fact that surveyor was paying attention enough to see a set of pale toes sticking up out of the snow, you know, the circumstances.
Yeah, and it was heavily wooded area too.
Yeah, just the fact that a dusting hadn't just covered it over, and then to find a random strip. There were so many different variables that play there. That's a break right out of the gate, right?
Absolutely.
Yep.
No question.
Yeah, and as I think about, I'm thinking back, you know, if we look at that, you find this guy, everything's covered but his toes. When the techs get out there, how long, how do they go about actually uncovering him? Like, do they, because I mean, you're thinking about all the stuff that you could be missing, all the stuff that could just be a couple of centimeters under the snow. How did they go about recovering and exposing that body?
Well, we did have some lights brought to the scene, but they weren't very helpful because it was just so dark because it was in the woods. And of course the weather was getting worse. The fog had come in. And so that really hampered visibility as well. So what we decided to do, after brushing just, you know, with some brushes and lightly trying to brush the snow, but it wasn't powdery snow. It was frozen. It was icy snow. So what we decided to do was take snow and all, and take a section around the body, good parameter around the body, and just lift everything from underneath the body with some special shovels, because the body itself was frozen to the ground, and we didn't realize that at first, but we couldn't move the body. We had to take frozen dirt, frozen ground and all, and lift it all onto a body bag and seal it all up so that when the snow melted, whatever was even still in the snow we wouldn't lose, you know, particularly trace evidence.
Yeah.
Were finally able to get him onto a body bag and get him transported.
And that's as I was reading, I was like thinking in my mind, I'm like, how would I go about that? Like almost like pedestaling, like if you were taking a body out of the ground, like just working that meticulous way around him, just to try and keep everything you possibly could. I was trying to visualize how you guys went about doing that, but just painstaking and freezing work.
It was cold and it was a little bit crude, because everything was frozen, including him frozen to the ground. But you know, you just have to do what you have to do.
Yep. Yeah. Just make it work. Trying to preserve as much as you can. And,
exactly.
And, for the sheriff to find that tape, just luck. So you get the body, you know, given the circumstances around there, the no gun and a couple of bullet holes. Every death's a homicide until proven otherwise. So
exactly.
How did it progress from there?
So of course the first order of business is to get him identified, because until we know who he is, we can't possibly, have any idea about a suspect or any motive or anything like that. So, of course, we had people searching the databases for missing persons, and we did come across a man who seemed to fit his description a couple of hours away in Salisbury, North Carolina, kind of in the middle of the state. We were up in the northwest corner in the mountains. And but I learned some things about this missing man that was just incredible, and I thought, this is not your ordinary case that's going to be solved in a couple of weeks. I had a feeling from the beginning. Yeah. And what I learned was that this missing man, who also had a watch and a ring described that seemed to fit the body that we had found, was actually not an American citizen, but a Swedish citizen who had come to the United States seeking political asylum because he had been arrested for the assassination of Sweden's Prime Minister Olof Palme in 1986. So
that changes
immediately. I was like, well, this is not a very good day to start a case of international intrigue, but here we go. And so we first identified him informally or unofficially through the watch and the ring. And we learned that he had been seeing a lady by the name of Kay Whedon in Salisbury. And she was familiar with his jewelry. And so we did show her the jewelry, and she did identify it as belonging to this man whose name was Victor Gunnarsson. But in order to officially identify him, we got Interpol involved and got a set of his rolled fingerprint impressions and dental records, and was able to positively and officially identify him that way. At that point, I'm thinking, it seems that all of my witnesses and my suspects and everybody else are probably going to be in the country of Sweden. And I don't think our county sheriff's office budget is going to hold out very long. But as it turned out, there was another very interesting set of facts in the case aside from the assassination. And by the way, he had been released from the assassination when the prime minister's wife could not pick him out of a lineup. And she was present when he was shot. So she saw the killer. And so Victor Benerson was released, and he turned around and sued the government for a false arrest. And he got some minor settlement, and that is why he came to the United States, to get away from the political pressure and pressure on his family from the media. But then we found another set of circumstances, and that is that Kay Whedon, who had recently begun dating Victor Gunnarsson, was the ex-fiancée of a North Carolina police officer. And that was, as you mentioned, Lamont, or L.C. Underwood, as he went by. And he had about 19 and a half years of law enforcement experience in North Carolina, and which never should have happened. But because he had a history of problems with women all along the way and violence. But Mr. Underwood, Officer Underwood, was extremely jealous. He was a pathological liar, and he was a stalker of Kay Whedon. And he did not want to let her go when she tried to break up with him more than once. But unfortunately, she did not know that she was still being stalked by him at this point. Wow. So now I've got a fellow North Carolina police officer as a possible suspect in the case.
Yeah. So you start off with potential international ramifications from the Blue Ridge Mountains to Sweden. Which had more gravity, the idea of trying to coordinate through Interpol and Sweden, or the gravity that your main subject was quickly becoming a fellow police officer?
They both were very intense in different ways.
Yeah.
With the Swedish connection, I was heavily relying on the authorities in Sweden to keep me up to date, to inform me of what they had investigated and the findings that they had up to that point, and to communicate. Not all of them spoke English, and so that was just, and I certainly did not speak Swedish, so that was a difficult obstacle to overcome, and to try to understand what was going on in their political climate, of which I was not familiar.
Yeah.
I was very familiar with what went on in law enforcement, and and it was disturbing to me that after learning about the character and the personality of Officer Underwood, I was very disturbed that if he was indeed the killer, that he might not only go free, but also, you know, he's still wearing a gun and a badge, and further victimizing, you know, possibly, because we did find that he was a potential suspect, or at least a subject in another homicide. And so both of them presented their difficulties as we began trying to conduct interviews and so forth in the police department. We found those that were loyal friends to him, and we found those that, you know, just basically wanted to throw him under the bus, you know, with whatever they could. So it was an interesting set of dynamics in investigating that case. Just interviews and the background investigation on him alone. And at the same time, we were trying to trace Victor Gunnarsson's steps when he was last known alive. And he actually had been reported missing officially on December 15th. And again, we did not find his body until January 7th. But as we investigated the case, we learned that he actually was last seen alive on the night of December 3rd when he was at Kay Whedon's house. And he was found to be missing as early as Saturday morning, December 4th. We did learn from the circumstances that he left Kay Whedon's house, and he did get back to his apartment, because some of the things that he was wearing and that he had at Kay Whedon's house, we found there at the apartment. But he was never seen after that. So he was actually murdered then during the early morning hours of December 4th. So he had been in the woods in my jurisdiction in Watauga County for just over a month.
Yep. And you go back to the variables of, you know, not only finding him, but the weather, you know, shifting 10 degrees one way or the other could have drastically changed what you had to work with.
It absolutely did. But fortunately, the The freezing temperatures preserved his body more than it ever had. And had he not been found, his body not been found until the spring or summer, as you well know, there would have been very little left to work with.
Yeah. Yeah. So this guy had, you mentioned he had history, but he also had 19 years as a sworn officer. So not only the tension of people trying to protect him, but also, you know, on the other side, which I've always thought, you smear one badge, you smear them all. So I don't understand the people who would want to try and cover for somebody, but he had managed, you mentioned he had past issues, domestic specific issues, but he also made it 19 years. During your timeline or your background, were you able to quantify how that happened?
Oh yeah, it wasn't much of a mystery. Back in the day, when he started, it was more of a good old boy network, and there was very little documentation in the personnel files. In fact, sometimes there weren't even personnel files. But so he worked initially for a chief of police, and he got into some trouble, but he was only part time, and so then he went to another agency where he worked, 3 or 4 years, and he started having trouble with women, and they would complain about things like harassing phone calls, and he was following them and harassing them, you know, while he was on the job. There were multiple reports of graffiti, a red spray paint in particular, where he would write some vulgarity about them if they tried to break up with him, to try and embarrass them. One lady had discovered that he had written something on her church, on the outside wall of her little white church, something very derogatory about her. Another one on the sidewalk, Kay Whedon later found graffiti on spray paint in red spray paint on the outside of her garage door in her neighborhood. So he would follow them, and then there began to be reports of violence. And so when he would get in trouble at one agency or get into a bind, he would just leave that agency and apply somewhere else. And the background investigations were slim to non-existent. And so if somebody didn't pick up the phone and, you know, word of mouth say, do I need to hire this guy? And then again, you know, it may be that people were glad to get rid of him. Yeah. You know, like, yeah, go ahead and, you know, he's a good officer. And in some ways, he was a good officer. He was
somebody else's problem.
OCD in a lot of ways. Yeah. So he was meticulous. He was always on time. His reports were neat and in order. And he liked to think he had his ducks in a row. So I can see how that it happened. And as I began to find those department heads and the sheriffs and interview them, you know, one sheriff that had long since been retired, I remember sitting on his front porch drinking lemonade with him, and I was asking him, you know, you knew that he had beat this one girl up. You knew that there were problems, and yet there's nothing in his personnel file. And his response was, well, just listen here, young lady. I just prefer to talk to my men man to man and talk to him eye to eye rather than have all that silly paperwork. And so, you know, I did not enjoy those conversations because, I had to maintain my cool and calm, but I didn't appreciate that attitude, and I still don't. But fortunately, of course, you know, everything's documented these days, but back then it wasn't. And so I could see how that it happened, that he got 19 years of law enforcement experience in across, you know, 5 or 6 different law enforcement agencies.
Yeah, from my perspective, it reads so foreign, because I had to take a polygraph just to get hired on by my first PD. Like it wasn't quite the SF-86 in the background to go to the federal agencies, but literally a polygraph. So it's like, and that's that was only in 90, like 8 or 99. So, and then, I mean, that's a decade, you know, give or take a decade, and how much things changed that much. But it's unfathomable to not have paper on somebody, you know, these days, really. I don't know. But man, it's just, it's so.
He didn't have a psychological enabling evaluation until until he got until there was an incident where he was where he had followed Kay and a date to a restaurant and ended up dumping a glass of pitcher of tea in her lap and making a big scene there, and the manager called the police department. So that was the first time that, you know, that he had just been blatant about what he was doing. And he was suspended for that and undergoing a fitness for duty evaluation. But that was the first. That was the first time.
Yeah, and almost 19 years, first time. Never saw the MMPI 2 until 19 years on the job.
That's right.
Yeah, man, that's exactly. I remember sweating that one. I remember the questions starting to repeat themselves. I'm like, what did I say last time? I can't, you know, like, I don't want to look like a psycho.
Yeah. Or what are they looking here for? Yeah, what are they looking for?
Yeah. What are you trying to get me on? but yeah, that's just, I mean, and as you talk about this, it's such a study in that, that domestic cycle and just the,
oh yeah,
degradation of a stalker, you know, just the escalation there. It's just disturbing.
Very.
Yeah. So,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to talk about from the autopsy, but no, continue. The background on this guy, just the way how far he went is just disturbing and fascinating all at the same time.
He was, and I'm convinced that, he had no conscience, sociopath, psychopath, whatever you want to call him. And he did have a terrible childhood. He suffered as a child and he was abused and neglected and then abandoned by his natural parents and then by other family members. He grew up in an orphanage, but, you know, there comes a point when you have to be accountable and responsible for your actions as an adult. And he never got past that point. His hatred for women was just unbelievable. He took a particular interest in me as I got involved in the case, as you know. And but he also became more violent over time as well. And so as I began interviewing the women that he had been previously involved with, ex-wives, ex-girlfriends, the story was the same, only it intensified over time. And the only thing different was just their names and their faces. You know, I could tell them, by the time I got to interviewing the last ones, I could tell them their story before, you know, before they told me.
Ouch.
And it was just, it was a terrible cycle of his behavior. And then the women, they were just terrorized by him. And, you know, terrified to testify in the case, terrified of what he would do because he was so cold and calculating. And by the time I got to actually sit down in a room and interview him by myself, the evil that was present was just, it was just so manifested. And I knew him, you know, inside and out by that point, but I was still a little bit unprepared for the level of evil that was present in the room.
Yeah, and I want to go through the autopsy and the forensics first, but
sure.
Just so that we don't lose it, was there? I don't think we mentioned it, but you were working with SBI, and was there another agency involved? And I was just wondering
the State Bureau of Investigation. Yeah. They provided an agent to assist in the investigation. So pretty much it was like I had a partner. And that was Steve Wilson with the State Bureau of Investigation. And then because of other incidents, including that other homicide I mentioned, that occurred in Salisbury, then that was being investigated by the Rowan County Sheriff's Office. And the detective that was assigned to that case, Terry Agner, he was also assigned an SBI agent to assist him in that case. And his name was Don Gale. So basically, Don, Terry, Steve, and I, we partnered up. We teamed up, and Steve and I did everything we could from our end. But it got to be so overwhelming that basically everything that we did was a team effort. Terry was just the lead investigator on the homicide down there, and I the lead investigator on our homicide in Watauga County.
Yeah, and what I was wondering about that and that team dynamic, when it was finally time for somebody to sit down with him, was there strategy involved in having you sit down with him as opposed to somebody else?
There was no strategy involved because we all wanted to get at him.
So it was just
unfortunately, he would not speak with anyone except me, and he requested to speak with me. But I was the youngest. I was also female, and I'm sure he probably thought I was the weakest link. And his, he probably thought he had an edge on me as far as his ability to extract information on me. As far as what evidence we might have against him in the case. That's what he wanted to talk about. He was in custody at the time, and he requested to talk to me on a Saturday night, which was strategic on his part. He knew everybody else would not be, everybody else would be gone. He's in custody. He's in a jail cell, and I read him his rights and put the form in front of him, the Miranda form, which you're very familiar with, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And he refused to sign it. He's like, no, I'm not going to sign anything. And I'm like, then I guess we're finished. But he wanted to ask me questions. And so his asking me questions gave me an opportunity to have a conversation with him that lasted probably 30 minutes.
Wow.
But he tried to blow smoke up my dress tail, But he was used to manipulating people, and he was trying to interrogate me.
Yeah, that level of
interesting dynamics.
That level of narcissism is amazing,
Amazing. That's right.
To overcome the 19 years of the police officer knowing, asking themselves, why do these guys never ask for a lawyer? Then to be sitting on the other side of the table and be like, I don't need a lawyer.
What are you talking
about?
But the closest he came to a confession ever, until as far as to law enforcement was he wouldn't sign the waiver. And I'm telling him, he's wasting my time. If he don't want to sign the waiver, we're not having a conversation. And, so he just ignored what I was saying and continued to talk and ask questions. And I said, you don't seem to appreciate the fact that what makes me different from all the other females in your life, Elsie, is that I already know what you did. I know everything about you. I know how you suffered. I know as a child. I know how you suffered as an adult. I know what issues you have. I know all of your relationships. I know all of your family. I know all of your friends, all of your associates. I said, I know everything about you, including the fact that you killed Victor Gunnarsson and Catherine Miller. I said, and yet I'm still here talking to you. And I know for a fact that you killed them. And his response was, well, so...
That was it.
He did not disagree with me. Yeah. Wow. So that's the closest that he ever came to confessing to any of us.
Wow. That's just, man, that's, so you guys ended up getting him, but he never wanted to talk to anybody else. Did he ever try to bring you back in so he could try to grandstand again, or was that it?
Shortly after that. Well, in very small ways, and not that had anything to do with the case. He wanted to complain to me about the jail conditions. He wanted to complain to me that, his bed wasn't, comfortable enough, and, because his back was hurt and blah, 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 but nothing about the case. It was shortly after that we had, his lawyer had requested a bond reduction hearing, because at that point he was arrested and he was under no bond. He could not be released. And so they requested a bond reduction hearing, and I had to testify in that bond reduction hearing. And I testified that to the facts that he was a dangerous and violent man. And one of the questions that they asked me on the stand during that hearing was, who has he been violent to? Who has told me that he has, treated women inappropriately? And so at that point, early on, we hadn't got to discovery or anything at that point. And I turned to the judge and I said, Your Honor, I said, you can hold me in contempt if you want to, but I'm not going to answer that question because these women are terrified, and he knows who they are. He just doesn't know which ones are talking and which ones are not. And I'm just not going to answer that question and provide the list of names to the defense. And I thought he might hold me and condemn. But the judge said, I'm not going to require her to answer that question.
Yeah, because you can probably just imagine the collect calls that would be just start peppering these women. Just going just with him.
Oh,
he's got
yeah.
all the time
well,
in the world.
Well, the thing is, if they'll see, if he had gotten released, he would kill them. There was no doubt in my mind. He would have made them pay for talking to me. And I barely got them to talk to me as it was because they were so scared. But at that point, he became so furious with me. The sheriff and I walked him back to the jail. The courthouse where his hearing was just across a little street and at that time. And so we walked him back from the courtroom to the jail. And when we got in that jail cell, he called me everything but a milk cow.
Wow.
I was no longer his best friend.
That was
the end of our chummy relationship.
Yeah. Had to be a little vindicating though when you find it, you broke him instead of the other way around. So you got him. But I want to, let's go back to the autopsy and see how you built and how you finally got him.
Okay. So in the autopsy, obviously the cause of death was the two gunshot wounds, either one of which alone could have been fatal. It was shot with a .22 caliber weapon. We knew the type of weapon that most likely fired those shots. And later on in the investigation, we had learned that such a weapon was owned and possessed by Underwood at the time. But because there was no clothing on the body, we had very little to go on in the way of trace evidence. And so we presumed that was the reason for the removal of the clothing and his tape bindings by the killer to destroy trace evidence. And of course, a police officer and he also had been a detective for a while. So certainly he understood trace evidence and so forth. So we did not, we had very little to go on, very little to compare. So when we approached Underwood about his .22 caliber, Van Wesson .22, he no longer had it, and his explanations for its disposition was very unclear. He told multiple stories about it. Ultimately told us that he had given it to a stepbrother, which he didn't even have a stepbrother. In the state of Ohio, we conducted a number of searches in Ohio and interviewed people, and that was just a wild goose chase. So we never did have the gun. Same with Catherine Miller's murder. She was shot with a .38 caliber Colt Detective Special, which he had, and we were able to prove that he had in his possession. It disappeared after the murder, and he was never able to adequately explain away what had happened to it, and we never found the gun. So we've got two homicide victims. We know the guns, but we have no guns.
Yep.
And I'd mentioned that Underwood was very meticulous. He was pretty much obsessive compulsive in his home and his vehicle and his personal property as far as being neat and very organized. And so we learned that the day after the Victor Gunnarsson was murdered, he took both of his vehicles, both of his personal vehicles. Of course, you can't pick one and not the other. If you're trying to cover a murder, and took them to a professional car wash and had them professionally cleaned, including having the trunk mats, which were carpeted trunk mats, shampooed and vacuumed. Now who does that?
That's
even the area, you know, where his spare tire was. I mean, it was just way over the top, even for him. And so that was suspicious to us, but we eventually got applied for a search warrant and searched his home in February. I think it was February 2nd, Groundhog Day. And we seized a number of items, including the trunk mats, out of both of his personal vehicles. And, you know, a lot of other things that turned out did not have much evidentiary value, or either circumstantial at best. And we also seized a length of electrical tape that was found on the back of his clothes dryer in his utility room. We seized rolls of tape that were there, but in particular, we seized this tape that was actually on a wire on the back of his dryer. And as it turned out, that tape matched, that came from the back of his dryer, was identical to the length of tape that Sheriff Lyons found under the snow that had the hair and the blood and the bullet hole in it, in 20-some different characteristics. The color dye lot, the wow, adhesive composition, the fibers that ran through the tape itself, the actual size of the tape, the thickness of the tape, 20-some different scientific characteristics that tape matched. So that was our first piece of physical evidence, and we were ecstatic to have it, because by that point we had investigated this case for like 2 years. We had lots of circumstantial evidence, no physical evidence, and we didn't want to take this case to the jury, and certainly the district attorney, the prosecutor, did not, without some physical evidence. So we went to the prosecutor with the tape evidence, and he's like, this is great, this is fabulous, this is not enough. He's like, go back to work. So which it turns out, you know, he was a wise man, he was right. It, you know, that was compelling, but it was not, you know, what we wanted to go into the courtroom before a jury with in a first degree murder case. But the lab had analyzed the evidence, and we'd seized hundreds of pieces of evidence to be analyzed in that case, but they had eventually gotten around to analyzing these trunk mats of both of his personal vehicles, and they had found nothing. They had done tapings to extract fibers and fuzz and different kinds of trace evidence from the surface of the carpet mat, and had found nothing. They had done vacuumings extensively, and we were very disappointed that, you know, there was nothing. There didn't seem to be anything. And this Underwood, Victor Gunnarsson, was a man that Underwood said, you know, I don't care what Kay Whedon does, you know, I haven't been following her around. And I've never heard of this man. I've never met this man. I've never seen him in my life. I don't know him if he would walk in the door, you know. So he set him up for a problem by saying that, because as the lab technician in the FBI lab was rolling up the carpeted floor mat out of his Monte Carlo, something in the light caught his eye. And again, we have, you know, divine intervention. And he saw a piece of what appeared to be a hair. And as it turned out, ingrained in the very fiber of that trunk mat, in the base of it, were 17 human head hairs.
Wow.
So the person that had laid on that mat and had writhed around and twisted his head back and forth, no doubt suffering and panicky, had caused his head hairs to be caught in the fiber of that trunk mat. And so we're like, great, we have from the autopsy that you mentioned of Victor Gunnarsson, we had blood samples, we had known blood samples, so we could compare those blood samples to DNA that would be extracted from those head hair, and see if we could, you know, have a match. But unfortunately, there was not enough of DNA to be compared in traditional DNA analysis. A lot of those hairs where he had squirmed around were broken off, so there was no root bulb on the end of the hair, and that's where traditional DNA you would find in a head hair. But you know, brainstorming and throwing out ideas, we learned that the Russian Tsar's bones they had been able, through mitochondrial DNA analysis, to confirm that these bones were indeed, could be traced to a Russian czar. You know, so we're watching that on the news, and it turns out that the FBI was going online and developing a database for mitochondrial DNA, and so was the U.S. Army Department of Defense. And so originally we were going to get the U.S. Army to do the analysis for us, but by the time we got all of those hoops jumped through, the FBI was online with their database. So the interesting thing about mitochondrial DNA is that it comes from the maternal side of the family. So you get that from your mother's side. Well, in our case, no one else but Victor Gunnarsson from his family had ever been to the United States, including anyone on his maternal side. So where mitochondrial DNA is found in the human head hair, if you think of the shaft of a hair as like the shaft of a pencil, and inside you have the lead, or what's actually graphite, and then you have like paint on the outside of the pencil, well, then in between you have the wooden part, and it is in that area that the mitochondrial DNA is found floating around. So long story short, those 17 human head hairs were a consistent in every way with Victor Gunnarsson's DNA. So because the mitochondria came from the maternal side of his family and no one else had ever been in the country, pretty much that was a conclusive finding for us that head hair had to belong to Victor Gunnarsson. And the jury found that, so as well.
That worked. That played out in court, huh? That's
yeah. That's, so it was the first case in North Carolina that DNA, that mitochondrial DNA analysis was ever admitted. And we won the case, which was awesome. But so, you know, he had said that he never knew, met, you know, had any idea who Victor Gunnarsson was, and yet it's hard for him to explain 17 of his human head hairs in the trunk mat of his car and with the tape that matched as well. So that's he had gone by. I'm sorry.
I was just saying that's pretty close contact.
Yeah, pretty close contact. So what had happened is the night of December 3rd, Underwood was stalking Kay Whedon, and he went by her house and he saw a strange car in her driveway. Documented that tag number. He went back to his house. This is when he was still suspended, and he calls up a buddy of his with the sheriff's department and has the buddy call and run the tag number. So he runs the plate, finds out Victor Gunnarsson's name and his residential address. And then Underwood went to his apartment, kidnapped Victor Gunnarsson, got him out of town, put him in the trunk of his car, bound him and so forth. And having 2 hours to drive and to reconsider what he was doing, he drove him up into the mountains in the dead of winter and marched him into the woods to the place that we found his body, where he shot and killed him.
Yeah, that little like you said, I mean, you know, when you lay it out, everybody has a bad idea every now and then, but 2 hours is a long time to come to your senses. So that kind of rage just how did you put it earlier? That antisocial, just lack of conscience had to have been at play. Yeah. Now I did want to mention
everything was about him. It was all about him.
Yep. I did want to mention, I don't know if you got to talk to the forensics tech that actually found those hairs, but and I could be wrong.
Oh,
but
yeah.
For him to find that, I mean, just, you know, when people think about it, they think about like CSI, where they have nothing else to do in the world but concentrate on this one case. And, you know, you mentioned the Bureau lab, and you mentioned the CID lab. But I mean, they're rolling out. They're a factory. They don't have days to spend on this car mat. So it's like they have to gauge their time. They have to gauge and balance out their energy and focus. And for him to, I mean, that's a Herculean effort to make that last ditch, to have that much attention and focus to catch that. That's such a small detail. Such a lucky find.
It was, and we had I'd had. multiple conversations with them along the way and in different evidence and so forth. So they were familiar with the case. John Bandura was the FBI analyst who was who had found the hair, and he called me directly. And he's like, and I was at my desk, I'll never forget. And he's like, hey, this is John in the lab. And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, I've been getting this stuff up, packaging, and getting ready to send it back to you. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. And he goes, but you're not going to believe this. And so instantly I'm like all ears. And yeah. So he told me, he was as excited as I was. I mean, they had worked the case and so many pieces of evidence in addition to everything else they were working. But he had worked so much for us that he was familiar with the case, and he was as happy, it sounded like, you know, as we were to find those hair.
Yeah. Such a win and such a yes. long chance. Yep. That's awesome. That is right. That's just cool.
Divine intervention. No question.
Yeah. Yep. And I just love to see when those people that just have that much attention to detail is just fantastic. So you've got the connections through the tape. You've got the tape to his house, the hairs to his car, the guns, honest person, but that's not as solid a link. So once you get those hairs, are you ready to go with the indictment then, or what else you got?
So I immediately went to the sheriff's office, and I'm like, I think we got him, sheriff. And we told him about the hair, and the sheriff's like, let's go. And so he and I walked across the street again to the courthouse. We went to the district attorney's office. We walked right in and interrupted the district attorney with whoever he was talking to. And we're like, I think we got him. And so the district attorney's response after he understood what we were saying was, why are you standing here? Why aren't you arresting him?
Nice.
So he was satisfied at that point. And so we decided to indict him, and we had a team plan for his arrest, and we arrested him and brought him back to Watauga County.
Oh yeah. So you picked him up in Salisbury and brought him all the way back up to the mountains.
Yeah. And that was a very interesting car ride too, by the way. I know we don't have a lot of time, but I sat in the back seat with him, the sheriff, and Steve Wilson sat in the front seat, and he would not talk to anybody in the car but me. And he turned to me and he's like, would you ask if they could turn the air up? You know, would you tell them that I'm going to do such and such or whatever? And they're sitting in the car, but he would not talk to anybody but me. Very, you know, very bizarre.
So,
I played the game with him.
It's so strange. And yeah, that close confines, two people being ignored. That's not
right.
At all. That's not strange at all.
No, not at all.
Yeah. So that was, and I don't want to take away, but that's so first degree rage, you get him. But somehow after you get him and he's found guilty and sent away, he's still able to keep tormenting and reaching back out to try and just keep
yes.
bullying. Is that how Raging On comes about?
That's very accurate. That's good perception on your part. And only this time I became one of his targets. And so I was compelled to write the story. And there are so many details that we, of course, don't have the time to discuss here. In first degree rage, I was just compelled. It came very quickly. I appreciate you saying that there's good readability. I've been told that I write like I talk, and so it's like having a conversation with someone.
Absolutely, I agree with that.
But then, what happened after the conviction was what compelled me to write Raging On, and it became a lot more personal. Hmm. And had a really good response from the first book. And they were like, but then what happened? And I didn't know if I would be able to tell my personal story, you know, but I did. And so we have First Degree Rage and Raging On by Paula May.
Yep. Yeah. I haven't gotten into Raging On yet, but yeah, just the way, after having this conversation with you. Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like you're walking me through that case like you've been for the last hour, but I agree. There's so much more of the fine details in that book. But so he when he was still reaching out, is that during the appeals process or was he just, you know, making the jailhouse collect calls, reaching out to other people, complaining on you, stuff like that?
Once he was sentenced, he was quickly taken to Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina, in the middle of the state, and out of our county jail. And from there, he had much more freedom than he had in the jail. In the jail cell, all he had was a toilet and a shower and a steel, you know, bed. But in prison, he had access to the library. He had, you know, he could, you know, had means of communication that he did not have in the jail. So it gave him the freedom to do his research as far as trying to find something to win an appeal with, which he did not. But also to continue to find out information about Kay and where she was and start his path of terror against me.
Wow.
Since I was the lead detective in the case that got him convicted, and plus being a female with his issues, it wasn't hard, I guess, a leap to understand that he would kind of fixate on me.
Yep. No,
and he also hated Don Gale as well, but for different reasons.
Yeah, no, I mean, think about him sitting there, no other focus but the person who put him there. And it's just all the time in the world, for him to just come up with something. That's, well, you know what? I need to have you back so we can talk about Ray John once I'm done with it.
I'd love to.
Yeah. Yep. For sure. But like you said, we've been going an hour, and I don't want to keep you. I know you got, family and stuff like that, but, I guess I'll say thank you very much for joining me. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah. And, so I'm looking at Amazon. Is Amazon the best spot for your book?
It's certainly plural? The easiest. Yeah. It's yeah. Both books are available in paperback, Kindle, and Audible. And, they pop up very quickly. First Degree Rage by Paula May and Raging On by Paula May. In fact, if you pull up one, you'll see the other one as well.
Yep. Yep.
I'm appreciative of the publisher, Wild Blue Publishing out of Denver, Colorado, for taking a chance on me and letting me tell my story.
Absolutely. And full disclosure, Wild Blue is my publisher as well for Blood Red Ivory, and fantastic right. support from that organization thus far. I was going to ask, when you were talking about it, I'm sitting there on Amazon. I'm like, I wonder, just because talking to you, I'm like, you can narrate your own book. And I asked Wild Blue, I was like, hey, can I narrate? And they were like, no. And they were very wise to do that. But I really think that you could pull off. I think you've got that narrator voice. I think it would have worked.
Oh my goodness. Thank you. God bless you for that.
Yeah. No, I was, I think my ego goes a little far sometimes, and it was their response to me asking to narrate my own book. It was the simple no. wise choice.
I understand. So the case was profiled on Dead of Winter on Investigation Discovery TV and also on Forensic Files. And so when they came and aired, filmed the story, I'm like, when should I expect my Hollywood contract? And they're like, don't call us, we'll call you.
Exactly.
So I understand.
Yep. Yeah, that's why whenever my kids ask for like an expensive Lego set, I'm like, as soon as I get my Netflix deal, bud. Yeah. I signed the contract on my Netflix deal.
Good luck to you. Good luck.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you.
But no, thank you very much for joining me. And once I get done with Ray John, if you're cool with it, I'll definitely have you back, because this is fun. And but anything.
Love to. Awesome talking with you.
Awesome. Thank you. And everybody, I think we're going to cut it there. And thanks for listening. And we'll talk to you again next week.